Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 143 on a Monday. Okay, so I love it, man. Today is like gloomy. I love gloomy days. Maybe that's why I like living in Ventura, California so much. There's this thing called the marine layer in Ventura. For you non-coastal types listening, I had to have it explained to me. It has something to do with kind of this little fog that comes in off of the ocean. I don't remember exactly how the pressure systems work and all that, but it's like it's always in the morning. And it's like, so in Ventura, I always joke that especially when you live near the coast, you wake up in Seattle and you go to bed in, like, you know, a Baywatch episode. it's like you wake up and it's just like foggy and really kind of cool. And just when you're like, oh God, I can only write so much more anxiety driven poetry. I really need some vitamin D. Then the marine layer burns off and the sun comes out and you're like, hey, let's get fish tacos and go surfing. So it's kind of the best of both worlds, but I don't know. I like it when it's, I tend to be kind of slow and melancholy in the morning. And so I like gloomy days because it's like, you know, it's like that friend that knows how to act around you when you're in your different moods. Everyone has that friend where you're kind of in a melancholy mood and they're like, hey, buddy, what's going on? Hey, buck up, little camper. Let's do this. Come on. We'll beat this mountain together. You know, and you're like, what in the world? Shut up. Oh, God. I just want coffee. You know, yeah. I think some places where it's sunny in the morning, it's like living with a morning person. And I'm just 100% against it. But so, yeah, it's a gloomy day today. I've been enjoying it, drinking coffee, getting myself going. And so I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the gloomy day. You know, what's that old song from, I was thinking about this in the shower this morning, from Garbage, that band, about I'm only happy when it rains. Yeah, that's kind of me. I like rainy days. I remember I had, I don't know if he ever listens to the show. If you're listening, shout out to Mike Belfield. I had a roommate named Mike Belfield. My very first apartment back in the day, and he used to always want me to give him a ride to school because he was going to Southeast Missouri State. I wasn't going to college. And I would give him a ride, drop him up on the campus, right? But if it was raining, Mike would be, I would wake up and go, hey, you want to ride to school? And he's like, oh, no, I'm going to walk. It's raining. Because he just loved to walk in the rain. I'm kind of like that, too. Not so much I want to go for long walks in the rain, but I don't know. Maybe it says something about my internal life that I like gloomy days. Anyway, so here we are on a gloomy Monday in Denver, Colorado. So over the weekend, on Friday early in the morning. So Thursday night, I had, oh, by the way, sorry about the rerun on Friday. Things just got out of hand. We had a huge event at the Augustine Institute, and the lovely and talented Mark Giesecheck, which many of you are very familiar with because he is my co-host of the Over the Counter podcast, and he is also a close friend of mine and has been on the show a few times. Mark has a new book out, which you should all go buy. It's called Light on the Dark Passages of Scripture. It is on our Sunday Visitor Press. And we've done an interview or two on here with him about that book. I need to finish reading it so I can ask more questions from the last third of the book there and bring him back on. But he did a lecture based on that. And man, boy, was there a turnout. About 135 people, I think. We packed, I know we got 125 chairs. They were all full. We pulled the bulk of the chairs out of the cafe, the short ones. And people were standing in the back and sitting in the leather chairs that are out there. So we're looking at about 140 people, I think, 140 people. Pretty serious turnout for a Friday night lecture. And I had wine and cheese, and boy, we demolished it. It was good. It was fun. But things got a little out of hand, and I didn't get to get a show recorder for you guys. So I apologize for the rerun. But I woke, so Thursday morning, I woke up early in the morning, just total insomnia, boy. Just hurting hard. just could not go back to sleep to save my life. And I picked up my phone and started kind of scrolling through Facebook and reading the news and stuff. And I saw that the new apostolic exhortation, I think that's what it is, right? Amoris Laetitiae, is that how it's pronounced? I'll have to go look it up. Was released by Pope Francis in the Vatican. So I knew that it was going to be a weekend of armchair experts and nitpicking theologians going after the Holy Father about every little possible phrase, especially regarding anything about divorced and remarried Catholics and people with same-sex attraction and homosexual unions of some kind. And it turns out so just for the record, I have not read the document. I've downloaded it. It is on the Kindle. I've read the first like six paragraphs of it, and I've read a few paragraphs here and there as they've been quoted by people, and I've watched. So I broke my rule. I swore after the last thing that came out that I was going to, from now on, when Pope Francis releases something, I'm going to save anything that looks interesting as I'm scrolling around, but not read it until after I've read the document. But I couldn't help it. I was just kind of interested. So I read a few, summaries. I read a few, takes on it. And so it seems like the real big issue, the bigger issue. So there's a real, real big issue. And this is, I think, what I'm going to talk about today. It comes to a head in the conversation about, families that are in irregular situations. And I'm just going to kind of talk about these issues because I'm not going to dig in and start quoting the thing. I'm going to hold off until I've read the whole thing. I'm just going to talk. I'm going to use this and the commentary around it for some starting points to kind of talk about some big picture issues. And I'm going to bring in a couple of things that I've read about the document just to kind of throw some gestalt kind of like paint on the canvas, as it were. And God, that was the most pedantic sentence I have said in a while. I think if you're playing the drinking game, you should drink, even if I didn't make a grammar mistake. I think you done shoulda oughta drink. Here you go, I'll make a grammar mistake so you can have to drink. Some gestalt paint on the canvas, as it were. Oh, I am insufferable. I swear, it's just, I am an extremely sophisticated, possibly overeducated redneck. And that is the truth. So I want to just kind of throw some paint on the canvas, so to speak, and just kind of get the broad brushstrokes of kind of some, what I think is the issue out going on with this and the pushback from it. And I want to point to a couple of articles that I think are really good, one of which I thought I saved in my little pocket and getpocket.com. I use Pocket for my saving stuff and reading it later. And I cannot find it anywhere, and I was looking at it on my phone, and I can't find it in my history, but there's a really great article out there that I'm going to talk about, and maybe someone can find it, or maybe it'll pop back up again on my feed on Facebook or something, and I'll tell you guys who wrote it. So if anyone hears what I'm talking about later, and when I'm griping about not being able to find this article, and you know where it's at, then email me at thecounterposition@gmail.com. And or just tweet a link at me at counterposition on Twitter, or throw it on the Facebook page or something. Anyway, that was an accidental promotion of all of our social media. Let's just go ahead and get it done. You can subscribe on iTunes. So I know a lot of you listen to this here thing we like to call the Counterposition in the popular portable on-demand format known as the podcast on iTunes. You know what? And honestly, this is a radio show. This is an online radio show. But so many people listen to this as on demand that I often refer to it as a podcast. And that's just because I'm coming from the background of the only media I've done before this was podcasting. And so sometimes I'm recording these things in advance now, though we're moving towards me being live all the time, sounds like. So That's right. You're going to end up getting to call and talk to me. I know. That's what I'm saying. So look for some live shows coming up soon, I think. Anyway, go to iTunes, search Counterposition. I think it says Breadbox Media Counterposition. But if you search Counterposition in iTunes, you will find this, and you can subscribe. Like, just subscribe, and it'll always come. Anytime I do something, you'll have the option of seeing it right there in your little phone or in your little screen where you can just listen to it in your car. Amazing. The barriers to communication with the media are coming down. It's a revolution, baby. I am kind of interested in this. And so, this weekend we had a little, I want to talk about a little more about this weekend. This weekend we had a little brainstorming session about a show that I've been joking about for a while. Not joking about, just kind of like throwing ideas out about. And and it just dawned on me again. I've talked about this before that you used to have to get some guy in a suit to give you a show, you know. And a guy without a suit gave me this show. But you can do this kind of stuff. You could do even video. You can have the equivalent of a TV show. You can shoot it, put it out there. There's all kinds of places people can buy it or look at it or something. The barriers are coming down. Now, the problem is that there's a lot of crap out there now, and you got to get noticed and curated in some way. So, anyway, that's going to bring us into my weekend a little bit, which I'll talk about when I get back. Let's head to the break. We'll be back in a second. You're listening to the camera.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to the Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. So, before we get going on the whole papal exhortation big picture thing, I just want to kind of chat about this weekend a little bit. So, I had wings on Thursday night with the Catholic Wing crew at Pub on Pearl. So, if you're in the Denver area, Pub on Pearl, Thursday nights, all you can eat wings, $5. And there's lots of interesting, weird Catholic people that kind of hang out and talk about everything under the sun. And so I was hanging out with the lovely and talented Peter Zelasco of Catholic News Agency. And I was telling, so I remember what I wanted to tell. Here's what I wanted to tell you. So I was telling, so in case you didn't catch it, on April 1st, I kind of played a little obvious prank and said that I'd been given a show on Viceland. And then Zach Candler got after me for giving it away and saying happy April 1st at the end. But some of you didn't catch that, and some of you thought that I actually did get a show on Viceland. And so what was funny is that, so this show that, this possible show that I want to do that me and Chris Stefanik were talking about during our interview about making me the Catholic Anthony Bourdain and running around and talking about ideas by looking at places and food and people and cultures and history and stuff. So I used that as a template and did an April Fool's joke there about saying that I had been given kind of this show by the new Vice.com cable channel, Viceland. And they wanted someone to run around and do kind of an edgy commentary with kind of a faith edge. And some of you kind of bought it because you didn't hear me say happy April 1st. So I was telling Peter Zelasco and a couple people at a barbecue last week and about this April Fool's joke that I had just pulled. And Peter didn't hear the April Fool's part and thought that I really did get the show on Viceland. And then when he found out that I was talking about the April Fool's joke, he got really mad. And he was like, no, that's perfect. You should totally do that. We should do that. I want to help. How could I help, right? So this started this idea that we were going to do it. So we had wings on Thursday night at Pub on Pearl. And we started talking about this, we decided that we were going to watch a few things I wanted him to look at. So we said, hey, why don't you come over? I'll make some food. We'll eat and we'll watch these things. Well, of course, they've been trying to get me to do a brunch for a while. And you don't understand, I come from a kind of a restaurant, catering, cafe background. So I can't just like make some food. I mean, I throw full on over the top brunches, right? Like I get the catering racks out and put the, you know, the Sterno heaters in and everything. And I cook up enough food to feed an army and all this stuff. And it's a lot of work, but we started inviting people and I saw quickly this was going to turn into a real brunch. So the idea was we were just going to eat some food and then watch the Francis. I've talked about all this on the show too. The Francis Mallman episode of a Chef's Table. The Spain edition of Parts Unknown. And the section where the nun teaches Michael Pollan how to make cheese and all that and talks about her cheese in the Earth episode of Cooked, those four documentaries. So we're going to watch those, and we were going to kind of talk about how to talk about things of kind of underlying the view of reality that we as people of faith have through kind of like culture and food and wine and travel and history and all that. So anyway, long story short, all day Saturday, I was like running around picking up food and supplies and stuff. I was out of catering foils and all this stuff, so I had to run all over God and creation and get all this stuff, clean the house. And it's just like, oh gosh, this whole weekend was spent either preparing for or serving and participating in this epic feast brunch. So a ton of people came over and started trickling in, and then it kind of got more people and more people, and some people backed out, and it was good because we basically ran out of food like right at the end. And so we had an all day kind of like feast brunch. And I won't bore you with going on and on about how important I think that mode of engagement is. There's something about food, wine, coffee, conversation with intelligent people who kind of have some wonder left in them that just is food for my soul. So, yeah, I felt for a second I was kind of back home in California, because I, that's the kind of mode we exist in out there around the Schneers and the Fikes and the Marings and the Bancrofts and all my friends out there, the Mileys. And, yes, it was good. Good weekend. A lot of work though. And so then I brunched all day, cleaned up, and then we went to 6 o'clock mass, and I was just like, I mean, I'd just been working, eating, and drinking the bulk of the day. It's just like, and I was just exhausted. I was in a good place. I was just absolutely exhausted, but kind of got my second wind during mass. And then Mark Giesecheck and I, yes, the same Mark Giesecheck from the very successful lecture on Friday night that I mentioned earlier, and also the co-host of the Over the Counter podcast for all you contrarians out there. We went to Williams and Graham last night. So I had never been to Williams and Graham. Williams and Graham is like this cocktail bar that's like a speakeasy. It's kind of hidden behind a bookshelf, and it's up in the Highlands, and it's a total hipster cocktail bar. And it was voted like by some big magazine or something like best cocktail bar in America. And they are like serious mixologists. These guys are amazing. And so we went in and we had a couple of their like feature cocktails. And the first one was good. It was just kind of a little fruity and a little sweet for me, but really complex, really interesting. Marks, they were doing like on the fly carbonation with this little capsule thing, and all, it was amazing. And it had like sake and all this stuff in it. It was cool. So, but then on the second drink, I said, you know what? I normally, when I drink cocktails, I like a Manhattan or an old fashioned. I like the kind of the different takes on the classic bourbon or whiskey cocktails. That's kind of my idea of a cocktail, if I'm not having like a basic martini or something. And so so the guy behind the counter, the bartender says, want you to try a Vucaré. And he tells me the whole story about the Vucaré was invented at the Carousel Bar at this one hotel in New Orleans. and it has this herbal liqueur called Benedictine in it, this Benedictine liqueur in it, and it's got this stuff in it, and it's like, it's got rye whiskey and brandy and all this stuff in it, and man, it was just a perfectly balanced old school cocktail. And I tell you what, I could watch those guys work forever. It's not like Cocktail, that movie where they're like shaking everything and spinning it all over. There's a little bit of that, and he's throwing glasses up in the air and catching them. But it's just the smooth, quick efficiency of like all the different uses of different sizes of ice and the pre-chilling and this and that and the shaking with the way that they just kind of know how everything works, and they're shaking stuff that I'd be afraid it would come apart. They know it's not going to come apart in a certain way and all that, and they're just moving. They just have all this whole pack of skills of chilling and mixing and stirring and straining and all this stuff, and it's just all muscle memory, and they can it's a beautiful art to watch happen. Some arts are really delicious in their end, but not really engaging to watch, you know, hence like sausage making or something. Though I kind of like sausage making. I think it's like cool. I like that process. But, you know, watching a world-class cocktail guy just make a beautiful, well-balanced, gorgeous cocktail is just, it's something I haven't really done much of. I'm not really a cocktail guy. I'm a red wine or straight bourbon or scotch guy. But I have a really new appreciation for this whole cocktail thing. And, oh my goodness. Oh, roasted bone marrow with bacon jam on sourdough. And these little pretzel bites that were delicious. There's pretzel bites, really good, really good, really spicy horseradish mustard. But the bone marrow, I've had the bacon jam before. There's a plate down at the Populist in Rhino here in Denver called the Bacon and Egg, and so it's got bacon jam on it. But I never would have thought to put these two things together. But they have the big, long, grass-fed beef marrow bones sliced long way, like a little canoe kind of thing, and they roast them so that that marrow is all roasted inside the bone. And then they put that bacon jam on top of it, and you use it as a spread on this sourdough. Oh, my goodness. All I'm saying is, if you're in the Denver area, go to Williams and Graham, maybe kind of a wait. You have to be kind of let in when it's your turn or whatever. It's just kind of a speakeasy feel. Bone marrow. Boom. So good. I've been a bone marrow fan forever. Every time I make like ossobuco or I make some kind of braise something, I'm always like, you know, sucking the bone marrow out of the little bone pieces. One of the earliest foods, man, actually. You know, thought about, we learned how to crack those bones open with a rock after the lions and all that had killed something on the savannah and helped make us who we are. So there you go. That's what happened this weekend. Lots of brunching, lots of conversation. So, me and Zelasco and a couple people, we watched all those episodes that I wanted to watch. And yeah, so we're kind of pray for us. And you have any ideas, throw them at me. We're kind of brainstorming a new show that maybe we might want to do a pilot of, that would be something really, really different. Kind of talking about kind of all the kind of stuff that underlies the faith, you know, not talking about specifically faith. I don't know how to describe it. We're not going to go talk about a bunch of Catholic stuff. We're going to talk about other things in a Catholic way. So we'll see. I don't know. Probably never happen. But anyway, let's go to the break and let's get on to the Amoris Laetitia when we get back and listen to the counter.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. Man, I tell you what, I am amped up. I've had too much coffee today. I'm talking so fast today. Oh, man. I stop sometimes during the break and go back and listen to myself a little bit. And I'm like, man, I am trucking today. I'm amped up. Well, I was tired. And so I started hitting the caffeine to get things moving, and I might have overcompensated just a little bit. So here's where I think the rubber meets the road on divorce, on people in with same-sex attraction, people in homosexual unions, same-sex unions, all that stuff, and the not just the reaction to Pope Francis in this particular writing, but overall these issues. I think there is the difference between, how to say it, the kind of pristine, kind of crystalline, you know, platonic, often, you know, ideal of theology. And we know what's right, and this is right, and this is how things ought to be, and, you know, and they, you know, they quote Thomas a lot, and they say all this stuff about, you know, and they make all these fine distinctions, and they anything that looks like kind of trying to do something to make this a little more livable in some way, or kind of meet someone halfway. We're still in this kind of anti-modernist foxhole, and they just freak out. There's just, you know, this, like, it seems like we're watering everything down anytime you try to talk about, well, you know, people that are in this situation are, no, yeah, here's the ideal. Here's what it really is. You know, and they start quoting all this stuff and just railing in the back into this idea of liberal versus conservative. And they just start freaking out of fear, you know? And then on the other side, I mean, yeah, don't get me wrong. There is a group, you know, mainly like the German bishops and a bunch of people in this world that are definitely wanting to redefine marriage and would love to co-opt the Roman Catholic Church to help do that. No doubt. With divorce or not getting married, or and just living together, and not, you know, or your homosexual unions or whatever. No, don't, I'm not saying there's not an agenda. There is an agenda. So I'm going to kind of bring together a few themes that I've done shows on. You know, yes, we're in a battle, but we've always been in a battle, and we're always going to be in a battle. And we have to learn to act without fear and without reaction, even though we're in a foxhole. You just have to kind of get used to going, okay, look, we're soldiers, we're getting bombed, but we're going to be getting bombed for 6 months. So we need to learn how to play cards without, and not make bad decisions with the cards just because a bomb went over our heads. It's like you're kind of stuck in a foxhole. That is reality. We are in enemy occupied territory. Yes, people are trying to kill us. We have to learn how to play nice and be kind of open-minded, genteel, wonder-driven, good people that want to see the good for everyone, even though some of those people might be trying to kill us. That's just how it is, right? So we kind of got to get out. Even though you're in a foxhole, you have to stop thinking like the foxhole, you know? I mean, let's go back to the gospel the other day that I talked about. You have these apostles locked in a room for fear of the Jews, right? It wasn't an unfounded fear. They had just killed Jesus. They had just killed the man. When these people keep asking Peter, hey, were you with them? He had good reason to deny Christ. They might have grabbed him and strung him up right next to Christ, right? They were trying to squash this sect. So if you were a member of, you know, a local club or something, and the whole town turned on you and killed your leader, and then started hunting for the rest of you, you would be a little careful when you went for groceries, right? I mean, it's like, and so they were kind of locked in a room, right? The problem is that the center of that community used to be Christ, and now the center of that community was fear, right? And then Christ steps in the middle of that. And what does he do? What does he do when he steps in the middle of all that? He doesn't go, oh, it's going to be okay. Look, it all turns out good in the end. You know, there's no, you know. No, he shows them scars. He shows them a glorified body, but it's still a body that's been through hell. Literally. Right? It's got scars. And but he's the center of that. So they are now a community that the center of is the body of Christ, but it's a wounded body. And that's the situation we're still in today. And I think that, how to say it, it's the one side wants to say that, no, these aren't wounds in our culture and in the church and all that. These are just a new way of being human. These are just a new way of being a body. That sometimes some bodies have holes in their wrists that you can put them in. And we just want to redefine everything and just redefine the brokenness as normal. On the other hand, they want, these other people kind of want to just go, no, no, we can just not accept any wound as being there and make, ostracize anyone who has a wound and force, just make a barrier and say, you're not allowed in this community unless you've got these wounds healed. Right? And I think that that's the big gestalt picture, is that yes, there is an ideal. There is an attainable, real ideal in this world of family, of the Christian life, of living holiness, all these things. But there's just the messy reality of the absolute carnage of modernity, postmodernity, and just the wake of the sexual revolution. And so, what's been the most interesting voice I've seen on the internet about these different ideas has been the voice of pastors and some of the bloggers who are also working pastors have been a really, really interesting voice in this. And I am trying to find, there it is. So Father Dwight Longnecker on April 9th wrote a piece called The Pope's Exhortation, A Paris Priest Perspective. And I tell you what, you want to see what's going on there? Read that. You want to see what's going on with the difference between armchair theologians and taking pot shots and nitpicking language versus someone who has to get down in the middle of the messy, messy reality of broken lives and broken families and, you know, all this stuff. Now there's another article, and this is the one that I said I can't find. I'm just driving me absolutely nuts. I thought I saved it, and I can't find it anywhere. So if anyone listening knows where this, recognizes this article I'm talking about, please, please send me a link at thecounterposition@gmail.com or tweet me one at counterposition on Twitter. So I think it was one of the Robert Barron articles. But I saved one, but I can't find it now. He said that the key hermeneutic to look at this, like almost anything that you want to look at when you read Pope Francis, is look to the poor. Look to the experience of the poor on the fringe, right? And when I say poor, I don't mean just physically, you know, monetarily poor, but definitely within that world. The not really sophisticatedly educated in the faith, and the people are just like common salt of the earth folks who have not, who kind of gotten lost when, because they were kind of part of the world that just was Catholic because the culture around them was Catholic and all the things were put in place. We just said the kids at Catholic school, or we just have a parish down the street and there's pretty pictures on the walls, and as everyone kind of remains Catholic and it all kind of sticks because that's what good people do and that's what the society around you expects you to do. And then that failed. And a lot of people by the time we're on our second generation of people that have just completely not gotten the faith, and they're not being supported in any way by the culture around them, it was too late. And we still have a contingency in the church that is like, no, if we can just have good Catholic schools, we just get more kids into Catholic school. And it's like, have you seen the Catholic schools lately? We definitely need to have Catholic schools, but we need to save our Catholic schools. We need to reform and revisit and reformulate and kind of refound our Catholic schools in a lot of ways. So he's looked to the poor, look to the people on the fringe. The people who have been the most trashed by modernity. And so Father Longnecker tells a few stories. Now, they're kind of conglomerate stories because he doesn't want to break the seal of the confessional, and he changes names, and he kind of, these are kind of like, kind of compiled from all the experiences he's had, but they all ring really, really, really true. And it just shows you what an absolute mess the average parish priest has to deal with. And this is what the Pope is writing about, is this carnage of the sexual revolution, these broken families and people trying to get back together and trying to find something out, and us making that easy, not hard. So we're going to hit this when we get back. You're listening to the Countess.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to the Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley. And here in the second half of the show, we are just kind of talking about the big picture of the new apostolic exhortation from Pope Francis. And my contention is the big key hermeneutic in this is the absolute ideal in people who think that Catholicism is something that exists in books and in history and in theory that needs to be, you know, held on to in some way versus something that exists in the broken, trashed lives of normal human beings, and ministry being a field hospital where, as Pope Francis has said before, we don't talk to them about their cholesterol level. We try to get the bleeding to stop, right? People are trash. And I think that one of the great, great articles that have come out so far about this is Father Dwight Longnecker. He wrote a piece, and wrong tab back to here, and called The Pope's Exhortation, A Parish Priest Perspective by Father Dwight. It's on patheos.com. And he just lays out these different, there's three stories he tells about people and broken families and how they got back together. And so I don't have the seal of the confessional. And so I don't have to tell a conglomerate story. I'm going to just throw this out there as my story. Okay? I was raised barely Catholic. I mean, we were Catholic in a way. We went to Mass when I was young, when I was real little, probably most Sundays. Mom and Dad kind of got the worst of both worlds, kind of the cold, dead clericalism and moralism of right before Vatican II. And then this, we lived in the St. Louis Archdiocese, so we were just a small town church that got experimented on endlessly by St. Louis Jesuits. And so Mom and Dad, you know, by the time they were having troubles and stuff, and Dad drank, and by the time I was 12 or so, Mom and Dad got divorced, right? So here's my mom, my dad divorced. Dad has largely walked away from any kind of organized religion whatsoever. My mom got involved with Catholic Charismatic Renewal, ended up leaving the church, and is now, to this day, a non-denom charismatic Protestant, right? Dad, as far as I can tell, hasn't darkened the door of a church, unless someone was married or buried, since then. So now let's look at my dad, because my mom is in a different situation. She is an active, believing, faith-filled Christian who loves God, and in a lot of ways, still carries a lot of the instinct of the real reality underlying the Roman Catholic Church. My dad got married again, and that was just kind of a weird situation. I don't know what happened there. I was in that weird kind of like teenage, stay away from your parents, don't get involved phase. I don't know really what happened. He got divorced. So mom and dad actually dated for a while again, almost got back together. Didn't happen. Dad moved. Mom moved, and my dad ended up marrying my stepmom, Pat. And mom and dad, dad and Pat have been married for way longer than my mom and dad were ever married. I think they've been married longer than that first marriage ever happened. So let's look at the situation of my dad. My dad has been married to this woman for a really long time. He barely ever sees my mom. My mom lives in the same small town. I mean, they may be bumping into each other at the gas station or something, but it's like they're in no way involved. My dad and I barely, I'm the only link between them, really, and I barely speak to my dad. Me and dad don't get along that well, and so to keep from fighting, we just don't talk much. So here's this real broken, weird family, right? So mom never got remarried. She's like this Christian. My dad still has a lot of questions and wonder and stuff, but married to someone else, not really looking. Now let's say that my dad said, hey, I want to re-engage my spiritual side, and so he, you know, maybe goes to AA, let's say, maybe quits drinking, goes to AA, finds his higher power, the whole thing, and ends up, because of all that Catholic upbringing, wants to reconnect to the Roman Catholic Church. So he goes, starts meeting with a priest or something, let's say, and then he decides, you know, goes to confession and starts going back to Mass. Now he's in a situation where this guy who's barely got himself back in any way is in an irregular marriage. So he's going... There's a camp in our church that thinks that for the most important thing for my dad to do, that he is objectively speaking involved in adultery until they get like an annulment. But think about, you know, it's like the St. Thomas says that the thing received is received in the mode of the receiver. Yes, I started twitching because I have PTSD. But that's a good, this is where that actually applies. The thing received is received in the mode of the receiver. And that my dad, the way he's going to experience that is, oh, hey, you have to jump through a bunch of bureaucratic hoops so some old celibate white guys off in Rome can tell you whether or not you're still married to this woman or were married to her. And it's going to be a giant roadblock. Now, I think over time, if someone like my dad came back into the church, then over time he would start seeing what these things all mean and all that. Now, the question is what everyone wants to camp out on, whether or not he should receive the Eucharist. And there's a giant question, East versus West and all that, and what could be done and what shouldn't be done and what violates the gospel. And those are all very, very, very important questions. I think the problem is, I don't think that this exhortation is really, from what I can see, isn't really talking about that. It's saying that we need to walk with these people. We need to understand their real, real, real experience of the faith coming from a seriously broken experience of the non-ideal, with all this confusion and concepts, all this baggage, all this stuff. And someone is going to try to crawl back into the Roman Catholic Church after, look at my dad, after a divorce, a second marriage, a remarriage, struggling with addiction, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of painful hurts from his childhood and baggage and all this stuff. Growing up, and he's going to try to crawl back into the doors of the church and try to live as a Catholic. And the question is, how are we going to react to him? are we going to say, okay, thanks for coming back. Here is a standard you must live up to. Here, let's measure you against the door. Oh, nope, you're not tall enough. Nope, you don't fit. You're not good enough. Here, let me give you a list. Now, I don't think that most pastors, even fairly traditionalist, hardcore, kind of like idealist pastors, would quite act that way, right? They would, most pastors, if you've made it this far and you're an ordained priest for a good while, you love people and you want to see people love Jesus Christ. And so when it comes down to the confessional and everything, you're going to probably be a lot more gentle than that. But ultimately, how that's going to be received is, look, I understand you want Christ, but you have to go jump through some bureaucratic hoops and go get an annulment right now, or you can just kind of observe. Now, maybe that's just the case, but I think that posing the question of what it means for us to accept these people that are trying to form some kind of wholeness out of a bunch of broken, non-idealistic kind of stuff in their life, all this carnage from the sexual revolution, is everybody I know comes from my generation comes from a broken family, seems like. It's like, we're going to have, this is a moment in our history where if we're going to have a kind of a resurgence and a revival, we're going to have to bring some of these people back in, and we're going to have to figure out what it looks like. Now, the article I can't find anywhere also made a great point. It points out that there's a chapter in the Apostolic Exhortation, which I can't find because I can't find the number, because it's in the article that I can't find, and I'm not too happy about it. But the show must go on. And so in this article, he points out that to be a family that is a fully holy Catholic family is not to be some weird family that sticks out like a sore thumb, right? It's, remember, the people that grew up around the Holy Family see Jesus preaching and they go, hey, isn't that the carpenter's son, the guy that makes tables and stuff? They didn't say, he probably is the Messiah. They've always been a little weird. I mean, that one time we tried, you know, it's no, they, it seems like that the holiest family that's ever existed, where there's one member who's the second person of the Holy Trinity, one who has the Immaculate Conception, and Joseph, who gets chosen to serve and kind of tend to this situation, right? No one noticed them. They were a nice, normal Jewish family from the neighborhood. And it's funny. It's like, it seems like, I think that we have to, I think that's something we have to keep in mind when we're trying to figure out what it looks like when we get it right. Because you have to figure out where you're starting. And I think we put a false ideal of what we're heading towards. And then we judge people against this false ideal. And we make these people that are already kind of broken in a broken situation feel and look even more broken because we're comparing them to this false ideal. I'll try to find that article and put it out. Anyway, these were just my random Monday thoughts about the commentary on this. I got more, but we're out of time, because I tell too many stories about weekends. Anyway, I'm trying to start piling into this document a little bit, and we'll probably be talking about that off and on over the week. Let's pull the plug. Pop the cork on another episode. Thanks for coming out.